Welcome to the Stella Podcast. For this panel, we are looking at the personal being political. When a lack of political voice leads to disempowerment, disengagement, and disadvantage, personal voices speak up. These four women next to me will offer personal testimony on the politics that affect them. So please join me in welcoming our host Karen Pickering and our panellists Nayuka Gori, Jax Jackie Brown and Rebecca Lim. I'd like to just introduce you to Karen, who will introduce the rest of the panel. So Karen Pickering is a feminist organiser and writer based in Melbourne. She was the creator and host of Cherchez la Femme, a monthly talk show of popular culture and current affairs from an unapologetically feminist angle. Karen was the co-founder of Girls on Film Festival, a founding organiser of Slutwalk Melbourne. Karen is the editor of Doing It, Women Tell the Truth About Great Sex, and is currently writing a book on menstruation and menopause in collaboration with the Victorian Women's Trust. Thank you and enjoy this panel.
Hi. So, I am Karen Pickering. I want to start the session by reinforcing what I'm sure the organisers have already mentioned, that we are gathered on lands that were stolen from the people, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and I offer my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and I ask you to do the same now. And I did want to extend my thanks to the organisers of today, the Stella Prize. Girls Ride Up is such a brilliant idea, and as Nayuka was saying yesterday, I wish that something like this had existed when I was in school. But you probably also should know that the internet didn't exist when I was in school. So it's it's, you know, about the context, but I do think it's such a brilliant opportunity for you guys to get together and talk about what affects you and what's going on in your life and how that could end up translating into writing, and that's brilliant. So the organisers have put together something very important, which is you. They've put together this really engaged and exciting audience, and you are here to see this panel, and I couldn't be more thrilled to introduce them to you now. Our first guest is a Gunai, Kurnai, Gundajmara, Wurundjeri and Yorta Yorta woman. She's passionate about climate justice, the rights of women and the self-determination of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. She's a freelance writer, and she has said in the past, real talk, decision-making spaces are often stale, pale and male. She's none of those things. Please welcome Nayuka Gori. Next up, we have a disability and LGBTIQ rights activist, writer, spoken word performer, public speaker and disability sexuality educator. Her presentations at conferences and universities, her extensive publications, through these she provides a powerful insight into the reasons why society needs to change rather than people with disabilities. Her written work has been published in Junkie, Daily Life, The Feminist Observer, Queer Disability Anthology and in Doing It, Women Tell the Truth About Great Sex. Jack says, practicing your pride in a society that tells you that you should be ashamed is an act of resilience and resistance. So please welcome Jax Jackie Brown. And finally, we have a writer-illustrator and the author of 17 books for children and YA readers, including Mercy, The Astrologer's Daughter and Afterlight. She has been shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Award, Indie Fab Book of the Year Award, Aurealis Award, the Davitt Award, and longlisted for the Gold Inky Award and the David Gemmell Legend Award. She's a co-founder of the diversity initiative Voices from the Intersection. And she has said, I am a fierce champion for strong, quick-witted female protagonists who aren't necessarily nice, likeable, tractable or pretty. And amen to that. Please welcome Rebecca Lim. So So as Beck mentioned earlier, other Beck, not this Beck, we're talking about of this idea of the personal as political. So it's kind of old school, I think probably comes mostly from the 70s, you know, feminists used it and it came out of the civil rights movement, the idea that there are political movements and they are about, you know, society-wide change and structures that hold people back, but that they're very much personally experienced by the people within them. So it's a really good way to think about the things in the world that you want to see get better, because you can not only see yourself as being affected by them, but you can also see yourself as possibly an agent of change to make them better. So I think it's a pretty empowering way of looking at the world. So all the panellists here are going to talk about this idea, the personal is political, and it would be great if you could, you know, while they're talking, think about yourself and place yourself within some of these narratives, or maybe even think about how different they are to the life that you've had. And I'd really love you to kind of think about the generosity and the guts that it's taking for people on the stage to share some of the tougher and more difficult things that they've experienced. And I'd just love you to listen to that with an open heart and be thankful for the trust that they've placed in us. So everyone on the stage, except for me, is going to present a testimonial, which is just their little capsule of words and ideas that speaks to this theme. So I reckon we'll start with Rebecca, and she's going to share with you her interpretation of the personal is political.
I'm really old school, so my testimony is on paper still, and I also I haven't got over that fear after like 45 years of public speaking, so if my voice goes shaky, just look away. As a child, I took refuge in books for lots of reasons. I lived in that tricky gap inhabited by the children of migrants to Australia whose first language is not English. And I love stories and make-believe, which are not considered good foundations in a Chinese family for a virtuous, worthy and serious life. We arrived in the early 1970s and people like me were invisible, except when we copped it for our weird lunches. We never saw ourselves in the media or in politics, sports or the arts, and even in the books that I read back then, I never saw myself. Stumbling into fantasy and science fiction novels as a kid had a profound impact on me, not because of their silly covers featuring booby half-naked women holding birds or cups, or their crazy plots bursting with wizards or laser-bearing men or magicians or escaped slaves, but because those books showed me that gender, ethnicity, religion, age and ability didn't necessarily stop you from having adventures. I still didn't see myself in those stories, but what I did see was possibility. You probably don't even realise that you're being told to aspire to a life that can never be yours. You probably don't also realise that one privileged story is being sold to you as the paradigm story, the more worthy story and the only story. I never saw a sarcastic, tall, overweight, scarred Asian teenager who loved reading in any of the books that I read growing up. So in 2014, I finally wrote The Astrologer's Daughter, which had a main character exactly like that. It was kind of for me, but writing that character was also a kind of visible protest. Because in 2014, there still weren't enough stories with Asian Australians in them, and there still aren't. I was tagged on Instagram last week as one of only six YA authors with Asian heritage in this country, and that's bloody sad. My entire writing life, I have resisted being confined to telling just the immigrant story, but I've consciously made the worlds that I set my stories in as diverse as my own world is. I've always tried to write more of the real world into the fictional world because it's one of the great lies that there's only one story from one viewpoint for everyone to enjoy. There are many stories from many perspectives. I'm a loud and proud genre writer who works across the boundaries of fantasy, crime, paranormal, and contemporary fiction. I'm very keen to normalise non-stereotypical characters and settings within Australian kids' books and broaden what it means to be Australian. I ground my stories in the world as I know it, and if that involves people breaking into other languages or being ethnic or overweight, scarred, mentally ill or desperately poor, then I do it. Apart from trying to craft a rollicking good read like every other writer in this country, I write to increase the net store of empathy in our empathy-depleted world. That's my guiding principle when I write. In 2016, after talking to publishers and industry experts for almost a year about setting up a potential prize for own voice authors, illustrators and publishing interns, I finally co-founded with Indigenous specfic author Amblin Kwai Molina, Voices from the Intersection, an initiative to support own voice emerging young adult and children's authors, illustrators and publishing professionals who are Indigenous, people of colour, LGBTIQA or living with disability. It's all very voluntary at the moment, but thanks to a lot of begging and leaning on friends and contacts in publishing, we managed to hold a pitch day in March this year where almost 40 emerging own voice authors got to pitch their story ideas to publishers like Black Ink, Allen & Unwin, Hachette Australia, Bonnier Publishing, Clandestine Press and Penguin Random House. Voices is also putting together a short story anthology for emerging and published own voice authors with Fremantle Press later in the year. We've managed to put the non-mainstream stories of blind, deaf, disabled and other diverse authors in front of some of the best publishers in the country. Voices is small and it's quiet, but it's a start, because one day my hope is that all stories and all writers will be equally valued.
Thanks so much. I just wanted to quickly, before we move on, to ask you to explain to the audience the own voice movement, because I just think we skipped over that in your testimonial and I think it's a really cool idea.
It's a concept that's been around probably since the 1980s, but it's sort of only getting wider traction at the moment. An own voice story is basically a story that's written from the perspective of the person who actually lived that experience. So while you often get, for example, a lot of fantasy fiction which is written in Asia, or set in Asia, but it's written by non-Asians, you get this kind of, if you're an Asian reader reading that, you get this kind of weird disjuncture between the things that seem authentic and the things that obviously came off Wikipedia. So own voice stories are like, they're written by the person living within that culture or that background or that experience, and when they write the story, the voice is extremely authentic because it's coming from within that experience.
And it's like the flip side, as you say, is obviously pretty tricky. Like if people in the audience are going to write fiction, obviously they want to make a lot of diverse characters, or they want to have a lot of different voices in there, but that it's a good idea to maybe really take care if you're writing a character that is not your experience, especially.
Right. I mean, I don't know if everyone's aware of the Lionel Shriver controversy from last year, but she basically said it's the job of the writer to do whatever they effing well like. And so she, you know, she basically said, I can be a Mexican, I can be a whatever, it doesn't matter, and I shouldn't be judged for that. But I think a lot of writers have said, it's fine, we do write fiction and it's great to imagine, but if you are writing from the experience of someone who is marginalised, you make sure you get your research right, you make sure it's absolutely spot on, because otherwise you've just offended an entire section of the population.
Yeah, and just to kind of take that responsibility and say, okay, it actually is up to me if you're a writer who has maybe more privilege than the...
More access, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
That you get things absolutely spot on and to, you know, actually...
Consult with people, collaborate, talk to...
And not create new stereotypes.
Yeah, and not contribute to things that might harm those people already.
And I mean, I think there's some interesting conversations happening online at the moment around should a writer, if they're writing about something that isn't their own experience, so should a writer... write authentically. So should they write a racist character in it and use racist language, etc., to kind of encapsulate what someone's experience of that character would be in their real life if they were a person of colour, for instance, or with people with disabilities? Should a character be using slurs against someone with a disability because they're still used in everyday language? And what is the effect of kind of perpetuating some of those stereotypes and discriminations, really? And, yeah, there's some really interesting discussions online of people saying, well, as a marginalised person, as a person who has that language used against them, it's actually really hard for me to read and it's really hard for me to engage with that text, even though it is my experience of life that people do talk and relate and behave in ways like that.
Yeah, and maybe it's also opening up a discussion about some texts are for different people, and that, you know, there may be there are texts that are kind of very 101 introductory texts for people who really have no idea that they would go and read them and feel like, oh, I had no idea that Australia was so racist, or I had no idea that people in wheelchairs were treated this way. But then, of course, that is going to have an impact on the other people who have to be in the world with that text and feel as though they're kind of being used to teach lessons or
Does it further normalise and legitimise those ways of behaving, I think, is the bigger, more interesting question.
Yeah.
Like, how do we use the stuff that the knowledge that these things happen to us and then frame it in a way that really gets people to think more deeply about it and possibly behave differently?
I just think, for me, the question is, like, would I read about a young black woman? Like, would I read about a young black woman from the perspective of a black woman if it was, like, written by a white dude? And I think for me the answer is 100% no, because not because they're a shit writer, they could be the best writer, but because they couldn't possibly do that character justice. Like, it's, I think, almost impossible. I think, and that's not to say that black women don't, like, only ever write about themselves, but I just, it's performance. Like, there isn't, for the white writer in that circumstance, it's very much a performance. They'll never understand the nuance or see the world properly. Yeah, I just think it would be, like, it just wouldn't be a good yarn at the end of the day. I don't know.
That's interesting that you're talking about the artistic problem as well.
Yeah, it's like a lot of rap. Like, Eminem sucks.
Like, but he's got flow. What he's talking about and how he's ripped off that experience.
Yeah, he kind of sucks. Like, I don't mind Action Bronson. But, you know, like, it's much harder. Yeah, there's like a lack of authenticity there, and it really comes out. I mean, it hasn't stopped Eminem from doing well financially, but if you were to judge him on his artistic merits, you would say he sucks.
Yeah. You have said he sucks. And yeah, it's making me think of the Iggy Azalea complex as
well.
Oh, yeah. So she does suck. Yeah. I'm more confident about that. But I think Eminem sucks as well. You heard it here first. No one else has ever said that about Eminem before. But we will, let's crack on and hear from Jax through her giggles about the personal as political, and then we'll ask her some more questions afterwards.
Cool. Okay. The personal is political. This is probably one of the most important things anyone will ever tell you, particularly as a person with a disability. This will begin your journey away from shame and towards pride. To quote the late Stella Young, and she was an amazing disability rights activist in Melbourne who passed away a couple of years ago, and if you're not familiar with her work, you should Google her. Her name's Stella Young. And she said, "You are not wrong for the world. The world is just not yet right for you." As a young queer person growing up with a disability, I didn't have any role models or any idea of who I could become or what my life would look like. And when I stumbled across feminism when I was 17, it was white, straight, able-bodied feminism. And while I will always be grateful for this, as it sparked my shift in perspective and the beginnings of my politics, it didn't speak to the intersections that I live. Finding politics which is intersectional and works for me took years. But I know particular things to be true. One, disability is not a personal issue, but an issue of rights and equality. Disability allows me to think deeply about the body, about power, about identity, to move through the world differently and to see things from a unique perspective. I am proud to have a disability. This is often difficult for people to understand, as the narrative of disability as tragedy or conversely as inspiration are so pervasive and strong that it can take a lot to break through them and to begin to frame it in a different way. So often the ways that we see disability in film or in books, if we see it at all, are kind of people with disabilities as kind of these sad figures who wish they could, like, transcend their bodies and be normal, or people who just sit at home all day and feel sad about their lives, or, like, the opposite of that we often see is people with disabilities as kind of heroic and inspirational just for, like, doing nothing spectacular at all. And that is, like, they're both stereotypes and they're both really boring. Like, often I'll be, like, wheeling around in the world, like, minding my own business, like, just cruising through, doing something, like, going, getting my groceries. And I'll just, like, feel someone, like, watching me and, like, kind of walking along behind me, like, just kind of looking about how I'm going around doing my shopping. And then they'll kind of, like, try and, like, in this cool but, like, really deeply awkward way, like, assist me with something that I don't need assisting. And then tell me how amazing it is that, like, I'm doing my grocery shopping. So, like, yeah, it's this idea that people with disabilities are just, like, inspirational and here to inspire people without disabilities, even though we're not doing anything, like, amazing. Anyway, so thinking about disability differently. So often when we think about disability, we think about it as like a medical problem, that there's something wrong with someone's body or mind that needs to be fixed. And the social model of disability says, well, no, a lot of the disadvantage that people with disabilities are subject to is because the world's inaccessible and hasn't included us in its design. So when I first moved to Melbourne 4 years ago, I was like, awesome, I get to go on trams, like Melbourne is known for trams, like amazing. And I jumped on an accessible tram in the CBD and I went to Fitzroy because I was trying to be a hipster. And I got there and I realised I couldn't get off my tram because there's no stops that you can get off, like you have to like jump down onto the street. And so I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I saw like this strong looking man and I was like, you. And so I jumped into his arms, which was a bit of a shock for both of us. He was like, what is this lesbian doing? And I was like, oh man, help me, I can't get off this tram.
Self-useful.
Yeah. He did. He like clung onto me and it was the closest I've got to a guy in ages. And then someone helped my chair down. But the point is that the world is like often really inaccessible. And so a lot of the things that I find really difficult and that I don't have access to are not because of my body being wrong. It's because no one's thought of like making the stops at trams accessible, getting rid of the old crappy trams, like making the world more inclusive and better. So that's what the social model says. It says, yeah, let's think about the society in which we live and the ways in which we think about bodies. So then disability becomes an ongoing interaction between the person's impairment, so the fact that I'm a wheelchair user, and the environment and attitudes that surround me. So the fact that we've got this really dicky lift at the front here that enables me to get on stage means that I can be up here talking to you all where most stages don't even have lifts. So that's an example of like how an environment can be made accessible to somebody. So then it's not the body. It is where that body is situated. Seeing disability as a social issue and not a personal problem, though, is still a radical idea. 45% of Australians with disability live on or below the poverty line. 1 in 5 Australians have a disability. That's 1 in 4 if you include people with mental health issues, or 2 in 5 if you include our friends or family members. So it's definitely not a minority. And 90% of people, if they live long enough, if they live into old age, will acquire some kind of impairment. So it's kind of a universal experience, really. When we think deeply as a nation about violence against women, we need not to forget women with disabilities. We are 2 times more likely to experience violence. And 90% of women with intellectual disabilities would have experienced violence. And 2/3 of those will experience violence before they reach the age of 18 years. The other thing I know is that these issues are political and that adopting a political perspective connects you. It aligns you with a cause, with others fighting for change and sharing an experience. You are not alone. Once you've seen things through a political perspective, though, there's no going back. There's just working towards change. Once you've seen privilege and disadvantage, you will continue to see it everywhere. You will continue to rage against it, to be saddened by it, and to believe that it can be different. And I think for me, the personal is political is something that is really deeply important to me and sustains me through some really hard stuff, because I think this is not just my personal problem. This is not just my personal issue that I might be going through at the moment, whatever that is. This exists in a context and in a society. And if this disadvantage can be socially created, so too can it be changed and dismantled. And so I think as an activist, sometimes change feels like it's just around the corner, and sometimes change feels like it's so incrementally slow. But I think the personal is political sustains me, because I really do believe that we can change things. And I believe that I'm part of that, and my body and my experience is part of that.
Thanks, Jax. I think so too. The question I was going to ask you, and to throw it out to the rest of the panel just to break up these longer pieces, was how does your writing, because we're here talking about writing, and you should know about Jax. Jax does everything, performs, writes poems, writes articles, makes theatre, out of control. So how does your writing connect the personal and the political?
I think it does, because I'm a feminist, because I'm a queer, because I'm a disabled woman, and I view those things as being inherently shaped by the society in which we live and the power structures in society, and the way that I view the world and the way that, I view my body.
So the writing that, I mean, I'm thinking of some of the writing that you do that is non-fiction, you know, advocacy, writing opinion pieces where you will, you know, take, for instance, a terrible film to task, but also then there's this other side where, you know, you're creating art as well. You write poems, you make theatre, you do comedy, so I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit, like, why do you do both? Why don't you just write, you know, strident political manifestos, or why don't you just write, you know, beautiful love poems about your gorgeous girlfriend?
I mean, because I think it's boring and it can feel constraining to just do one. Like, my kind of political talks and presentations and articles have this earnestness to them, kind of like that thing probably did, about, like, we need to change things, change is here, we can do it, let's just get on with it, which is great, and I really believe in that. But then a lot of my performance stuff is, like, really cheeky and funny, and, like, it still has a, like, kind of political message, and I weave in the personal there, obviously, because I feel like that's really important, and often we don't hear stories of people with disabilities having sexualities or being in relationships or being happy with their bodies and who they are. But, yeah, I really like that I have kind of two different elements to my work and my life, in that I get to talk about these issues in two really different ways that kind of enable me to frame it differently, but also to have fun with it. Like, I do think we need to be serious and earnest and kind of put the message out there and hope to shift perspectives and get people on board to change the world. But I also think we need to have fun while we're doing it as well, because it can be really exhausting to just, yeah, kind of plug away at it in a earnest way all the time.
Do you want to answer?
I mean, that's a sort of, she's like a practical example of, you, with your own writing, guys, you should never say, I'm just going to write historical romances. That's all I'm good at. I can't do anything else. What Jax is doing is she's using the skills she's got, and she's playing across boundaries with genre, you know, with memoir versus, you know, fiction versus poetry versus performance. So, I mean, the writing skills that you guys have, don't ever say to yourself, I can never do anything that's just in the second person, or I can never write anything that doesn't cross, you know, more than two boundaries or three boundaries. You can always play with it, and you should always be really brave with what you're doing.
What was the question? It was how...
How does your writing connect the personal and the political?
Great question. How does it connect? I think the thing I like to use... because I don't know about you, but every time growing up, because I grew up, my dad was like, he's like my stepdad, but I call him dad, black families. Anyway, he was like quite, looking back, kind of like low-key militant. Like I had particularly Caucasian taste as a kid. Like I love the show Frasier. You're probably way too young to remember that. Anyway, basically, it's a show about these like rich white dudes in a city that I don't remember, and I still really love the show. And I don't know why 10-year-old Nayuka loved it, living in freaking Billawheeler in Queensland. But I loved that show, and like Becca and stuff. Anyway, very white taste as a little black girl. But and my dad, I remember I was like. Came into the lounge room and was like, oh, you know, can we watch Frasier? And Dad was like, no, it's too white. So I was like, not allowed to watch Frasier as a kid. And instead, the films that we would watch were very somber Aboriginal films. So somber. Even now, I've got like, so, I don't know, some trauma. Whenever I watch Aboriginal, like black films, I'm just waiting for the terrible thing to happen. I'm waiting for an overdose. I'm waiting for suicide. Like, I'm just waiting for that shitty thing to happen. But that's often the case. I think that's often the case around black stuff. It's all very serious and somber and close the gap and deaths in custody. It's all very, very serious. When I know, and it is, like, I don't want to write that, I don't want to say that the serious stuff doesn't exist. It absolutely, it's pretty crappy a lot of the time. But we're also freaking funny. Really, really funny. Really hilarious. And I'm surrounded by the funniest people all the time. And it's, I think, it's a mechanism we've developed, I think, dealing with 200 plus years of shit. It's a survival thing. So I like to use humour to punch up, but also to make fun of ourselves as well. So humour for me is the thing. And also using things that happen, like pop culture as well, to it's easy to explain things if people know, like, oh, this is a thing Kendrick said. Well, what Kendrick said also is like this thing, and it helps people understand. So, yeah, humour and things that happen in the world.
Yeah, and I love that idea, like you said, that people who experience real difficulty, like the really freaking hard stuff, often use humour as a way to cope with it. And, you know, there's a term called gallows humour, which you could look up, which, you know, even the term itself is very confronting, which is that, you know, if you're being hanged and you were on the gallows, you would crack a joke just to kind of cope with the intensity of your situation and all your fear and your terror and your, you know, pain. You would just kind of crack a joke. Like, has anyone ever done that? Like, you find out something really terrible and you kind of, you know...
LaMayo! like, when my mum... This is probably a weird story, whatever. We're all friends. When my mum told me her and my stepdad were getting a divorce, part of me was like, finally? The other part was, like, my immediate reaction was just to laugh. I was like, I just found it hilarious. Because it was, like, a long time coming, to be fair. But I just laughed. Like, there is something when absurd things happen, like, you react, you've got to laugh. You will literally cry otherwise. Yeah,
exactly. And you can do both. You could maybe laugh and cry at the same time. And sometimes, whether it's the stuff you're dealing with in your everyday life or your home feels unsafe sometimes, or, you know, the very real shit that you go through when you're a teenager, or, you know, with your friends and boyfriends, girlfriends, whatever. Like, it's real. It's really difficult and tough. And one of the ways that you'll get through it is to kind of be able to find what's funny about it, or find, or with the people that you trust, you know, be able to laugh at a joke about it. When my grandma died, and you know, she was my grandma. She was old, and it wasn't the end of the world, was for her. But I delivered the eulogy, and I remember really agonising. I was quite young, and I agonised over whether or not to put this joke in to the eulogy, and I did, and it killed. Didn't kill my grandma, but it did. It brought the house down. It was like, you know, a couple hundred people, and the joke was very cheap. I mean, very, you know, I'm sort of ashamed to tell you that it was that I said, you know, we won't have to eat her cooking anymore. She was a genuinely terrible cook, and she was a farmer's wife, a farmer herself, and so she had to cook for a lot of people, and so many, many people had to suffer through her genuinely very bad cooking. And I mentioned all the other things about her that were beautiful and amazing and excellent, but I just thought it was funny to kind of lighten that mood, and you just felt this kind of ripple go through, and it was a relief, I think, almost like we were all like this, and then we could kind of really cry then, really kind of get into how sad it was, and that every time in the future when we ate a very bad meal, we would think of her. And I have. Curried sausages.
Hey, that is some fine Aboriginal cuisine. Was she black?
She curried them when they had gone a bit off.
Oh!
Because she lived through the Depression. So if she got the sausages out and they were a bit, she would go, curried sausages tonight, we're not throwing them out. Yeah. I've probably told you too much about my grandma. She was a rad lady, but yeah, hardcore. So now I reckon we'll ask Nayuka to share with us her testimonial about the personal as political, and we'll have more questions after that.
Negato. I had this other thing yesterday that I read out, and I'm not going to read it out today. That's irrelevant for you right now, but for anyone who was here yesterday, it's not the same thing. So personal is a political. There was an essay called The Personal is a Political that came out, I think, in 1969, or 1970. I don't remember which year it was. I was very much not alive, and neither was my mother. And it was basically, like, it starts off talking about how when there's a personal problem, you get therapy and you fix up the personal problem. And then it kind of, I read about two paragraphs of the essay because I have the attention span of something that doesn't have a big attention span. I think people say goldfish or like whatever. Anyway, I struggle to like keep reading things. It really takes a lot. Maybe the internet is at fault there. Anyway, so I read two paragraphs of this essay. I'd go read it. It was a really good two paragraphs. but it said like, when there's a personal problem, we go get therapy to fix the individual. But then it was kind of like, for a lot of women at the time, there were all these problems that were seen as like personal problems. But if like millions of people are suffering from the same problem, you kind of have to ask some questions about that. Like maybe there's something in the water, or, you know, maybe something's wrong here. And I feel like being black, that's often, and growing up black in Queensland, and even today, actually, we live during quite conservative times. Well, when I was growing up, it was during John Howard, who was another old white dude. And so you've also got old white dudes in power, so that's good, we've got that in common. But he was a different old white dude. And yeah, he was super conservative, and he, like, his brand of conservatism, and it was like, you know, you've got this personal problem, so if you just try hard enough and if you just work your guts off and pull yourself up by the bootstraps, then you'll fix that personal problem and everything will be okay, and you just keep going up the system and buy yourself a nice house that you can't afford, and then, you know, you have your couple of kids and then you settle, you know, you'll be happy, and then you'll get your superannuation and then you pass away. And so that's life. And anyway, so for a lot of black people, that's kind of what we heard, like, just pull yourself, you know, you've got this personal problem, just fix it, you'll be fine, just get over it, fix it. But it's like there are 500,000 of us, so give it, yeah, I think that's about right. Google. And like we've all got a lot of the same sheer stuff happening, right? So it's like Is it a personal thing that we just go get therapy for, or is it, like, is there something in the water? So for me, the personal is the political is like, hey, this isn't just happening to me. This is happening to so many other people that I know, and we need a different way to look at this. We can't keep pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps. There are other things getting in the way. And so I guess, like, yeah, grew up in Queensland, moved down here, started writing like a year ago, maybe just over a year ago, but was always very pissed off. And I think one of the most important things to be in the world is pissed off. I don't think change has ever happened if people were blasé. Like, you got to get angry. I think anger is quite it's a good emotion to have. Anger moves people. And then what you do with that anger is like, can be very, very beautiful or destructive or both. So I started writing last year because, someone asked me to. And if someone asks you to do something, unless you don't want to or it's going to be terrible or you can't do it at the time, for me, my answer is always like, count me in. And then I get debilitating anxiety about being counted in. And then you do it and you don't sleep, but you do it. Anyway, anxiety. So someone asked me to do something and then so I did it. And then I kept getting asked to do things and kind of kept doing it. And I think it's been important for me to write because the only reason why I said yes was because there were two other women, Aboriginal women, that I saw. Most of my writing's online. I love the internet. I live in there. I hope to live in there properly one day. I want my ashes to be buried in the internet. There were only like two other black women that I was seeing at the time on the internet, and that was Amy McGuire. Write these names down. Amy McGuire, that's McQuire. Amy, she's a Durrumbal woman from Rockhampton. And also Celeste Little, write her name down. So Celeste and Little is DLIDDLE. And I love their writing. I love it. I still love their writing. I follow their writing. And I think if I hadn't seen them do their thing, I would have said no, because like it's really hard to venture off and feel alone in the world. But because there were people already doing it, I thought, yeah. And also I was like, I need the money. So the reason why I think we're talking about our own voices and, you know, writing from the intersection or writing from the margins, I think more so than other people, particularly oppressed groups, whether you're queer or trans or black or whoever you are, it's like we've had the Western canon is so pasty and so boring, and it sends me to sleep. We desperately need people from different backgrounds doing their thing because, like, it can be so boring. And we see what magic happens when we have people who aren't, you know, from the centre, like, writing. It's magic and it's hilarious and it's brilliant. And the world gets better that way, in my humble opinion. But I think also there are perspectives that we miss out on, and we were talking before about whether or not, like, if you're not from that experience, whether you should write about it. And like I mentioned, like, for me, I used to go on angry rants about whether or not it was ethical to do that. I still don't think it is, but now I'm like, will it be good? It probably won't be a good, like, artistically it'll be a piece of crap because people can't possibly write from someone else's experience in a real way. I don't know if it's possible. But if you're from some sort of marginalised group, I think you write and see the world in a much more interesting way. And there's a dude, I'm going to butcher his last name, Bois. It's, I don't know, what it is, black dude. Anyway, so he was writing quite some time ago, and he was writing about the relationship between the master and the slave, so talking about America, although we did have slaves here. And he was talking about the consciousness that people have, and he talked about how the slave develops a double consciousness. So to do well in the world, the slave, and you could kind of, I mean, you could kind of extrapolate this out, but he was saying that the slave develops a double consciousness. That means the slave is not only to do well, to survive, the slave has to know the slave world, but the slave also has to know the master's world. But if you're a master, you only, to do well in life, you only need to know the master's world. You do not need to know the slave world. So in my mind, those who are oppressed or kept out of, you know, kept out of particular places or whatever it might be, we develop particular tools and see the world in a way that is far more interesting. We see things that other people cannot see, and it is makes for better entertainment. It makes for more better thinking in my mind. And I know definitely for myself, it's something that I've had to develop. Often I was the only black kid at a school, or in the case of year 11 and year 12, there were a couple of us in year 11. At the start of year 11, there were like maybe four or five black kids, and then by the end I was the only one who graduated, which is not uncommon. And so for me it meant knowing how to make white people feel comfortable, and, you know, what sort of jokes to crack or whatever it might be. And then I could go home and be around my black family and do very well there as well. I mean, it's family, how do you do well? You just be yourself. But I developed a way of, like, communicating with everyone and seeing the world, seeing a whole bunch of different worlds, that I think has made me a much better writer now and hopefully makes the world better in some way. Anyway, that's all I've got for now. Thanks for listening. Listener Solange, Princess Nokia as well is really good. Yeah.
Let's thank Nayuka. I was going to pick up on a couple of things that you said and just really summarise them so briefly. One, if someone asks you to write something and they say, I'm asking you because I think you're a good writer, believe them. That's something important, because I think that girls especially and women, their first instinct is to say, oh, no, I can't write. Like, I'm terrible. Why would you ask me? You know, ask someone else, or there must be someone better for this. So when – and I've been on both sides of that as an editor and someone who books people – saying, why would I book you if I thought you were garbage? You know, I want you. You're the best. But then if I get booked for something, I immediately say, oh, surely there's someone better. I don't think I can do this, you know. So that's something to get ahead of really quickly. The second thing is that Nayuka was saying that she had only seen a handful or, you know, just a couple of other black female voices, and they were both – that was both empowering and like emboldening to you, but also that's not enough. So then maybe if you can see that your experience and your own voice is not being heard and seen, that might be a little clue to you that it's how important it is to get your perspective out there. And then the third thing is get paid.
Yeah, no, seriously, get paid.
Really important.
Get paid, because if you don't, well, like you're priceless. Obviously, but also, you know, if you're doing something for free that should otherwise be paid, you might be being exploited. But also, it drags the rest of the community down. It places an expectation on everyone else that they shouldn't get paid. If you're in a position where you can afford to not be paid for your work, congratulations, good for you. But everyone else in the community isn't necessarily there.
There'll be times where it's good to work for nothing, like on your student newspaper or whatever. But if everyone's working for nothing, that's okay. But if somebody asks you to write something and you can figure out that other people are getting paid or there's advertising on that site, ask for some money.
And I also think don't be afraid to approach other slightly older women or women who are writing and say, what do you normally charge to write for this publication? Or because I think often in the writing industry, we don't have rates. We don't really have a union as such to go, okay, what should we be?
We do, but it's just ignored. Yeah. So there's a union and there's an industry rate. And the industry rate's much higher, probably something like 7 times higher than what the average publication pays. So, when I write, so I've written some pieces for, say, The Guardian, and so you think, wow, Karen wrote for The Guardian. She must be getting paid so much money. It's $120.
No way, really?
Yeah, for me to write a you know, really highly researched, thorough piece where the editor will say to me, I need this in like 3 hours because it's about this thing that's happening right now, and you give your baby to somebody and bust your gut and, you know, make sure it's perfect and anticipate every single comment that's going to be written saying you're a garbage person, and then you get paid $120. So, no. I mean, it's but that's better than nothing.
And if you're lucky, you'll get paid on time. If you're really lucky.
Not 2 months later. My really crappy example of what you should say no to, I had a white film director email me spontaneously and go, oh, I've got a couple of paid white male scriptwriters who are writing this Chinese teenage character for me, and we're doing a kung fu movie, but there's something really wrong with her voice. Can you just fix it for free? Because you're one of the few Chinese people in this industry. And I was like, bugger off. Because that's what happens.
I hope you use stronger language.
Yeah, slightly stronger. But it's ironic because the guys will take care of themselves. They'll all get paid. But there's something really wrong with the voice because we actually don't come from that experience. None of us know kung fu. We're not Chinese. We're not female. And so they go to the woman, you know, who's sort of around and goes, you know, it'd be a real honour for you to fix it for free. And really, at this point, you can just go, no, it's not.
And I mean, I think it's political to ask for payment.
Yeah.
Often for people with disabilities, we're always asked to do work for free. We're asked to come speak on this panel, consult about access, whatever, whatever. And yet they'll pay, you know, like a white, able-bodied access consultant thousands of dollars to come do something that they're going, oh, can you just come and check out this venue? So I think it's political to go, actually, my time is worth something, my expertise is worth something, and I've got a form email now that I send when I get people just sending me like an email going, so I've got this thing and I think it'd be really good. I'm like, here's my rates and here's why they're important, because asking marginalised people to do work for free is actually, you know, politically not okay. So I think that's important. It's important to not be scared to ask other people what their rates are and get them to support you and help you. And, you know, if they can, give you networks and opportunities, but also to respond really boldly to requests for your time and energy for free.
Just send, guys, we're doing. Rihanna's bitch better have my money. Just send that.
Send a GIF.
Yeah.
Send them cash rules, everything around me. Okay, maybe no, not the Wu-Tang. You will hopefully all leave today feeling like you can look inside that rich inner world that's going on in your head that you live with every day and realise that it's actually amazing and fascinating, and it just seems normal because it's what you're used to. But actually, if you can somehow capture that and get it down on paper, if you're old like us, or on screen, or, you know, get it out of your head and into words. That's, I think, one of the really amazing things about writing. And to go back to our kind of guiding principle of the personal is political, that, you know, for you to be a girl or a woman in the world who writes their truth, and whether or not that truth is science fiction fantasy or poetry or stand-up comedy or you know, political tracts, anything that you write that is truthful and comes from you, that's a political act. And so hopefully we'll be reading your words in the future and seeing how they help to, you know, make the world a better place. So thank you so much, and please join me in thanking the panel. We do have to wrap up. There does seem like there are a couple more questions, so you might be able to grab one of the panellists outside and or certainly keep having this conversation with each other. Thanks so much.